Chapter 4. There was an abounding silence after the cockatoo woman proclaimed what she did, and Rylan and I exchanged looks. Then Rylan sighed, and his expression seemed to portray that a half-naked cockatoo woman talking about life or death without any sort of context seemed, if not normal, something he'd at least witnessed in the recent past. The way he suddenly cleared his throat and shot me another look confirmed my suspicions. Something had been going on with my loyal estate manager while we'd all been gone, but the question was, what?
"I'm going to go see if any of the Terrans need help crossing from the courtyard to the palace," Rylan said, as he gestured over his shoulder with his pointed thumb. "I'll catch up with you later, Dad."
"Good idea, kiddo," I said, and squeezed his shoulder, and when Vel wasn't looking, I mouthed a quick thank you to him before he ran off. Then I turned my attention to the enigma before me.
"Alex Brightwood,"
she said once more, and her voice sounded like she had the worst case of laryngitis in the world. It creaked and groaned through her vocal cords like a rusty screen door. And had we been close to any source of water, I would have interrupted her in order for her to take a drink. As it was, I could do nothing but stand stock still and wait for her to talk. But she didn't make another move, and I internally sighed when I realized I would have to get the ball rolling. "How have you been, Vel?" I asked her as I took a tentative step toward her. "Do you feel all right? You look a little pale." Then, quicker than I thought she was currently capable of, the cockatoo woman rushed at me faster than I was prepared for, and the end result had her and her fathomless black eyes just inches away from my face.
"You must heed me,"
she said with a low, burning intensity.
"Do you promise to heed me?"
"Well, considering that it is life and death, I do heed you," I said, and I made sure my tone was absent of any facetiousness. Whatever it was she had to tell me, she fully believed it, and for all of our problems in the past, the last thing I ever wanted to do to anyone on my crew was belittle them. "What is this about?" My question seemed to give her pause, and she backed up a half step out of my space, which was a bit of a relief.
"This is about life and death,"
she said with a confused frown as if she was unsure as to why that needed repeating. Then she rummaged around in her robe and pulled out an object with little aha noise.
"Aha! See?"
The cockatoo woman held up what appeared to be a plain silver service bell with a decorative handle. It was definitely a nice little trinket, but I failed to see what a bell had to do with life and death. I didn't want to be rude, though. After all, her intense expression tipped me off that I'd better take this just as seriously as she did. "I have to admit, I don't see, but I trust you," I said before she could get upset. And then, to make sure she knew I was sincere, I took the ordinary-looking bell from her shaking fingers and tucked it into my armored belt, so the handle was visible for her to see. "I'll never go without it."
"You shouldn't,"
she agreed with a frantic nod.
"Not even between rooms. It must be on your person at all times. Do you understand me?"
Instead of calming her down like I thought it would, me going along with whatever her superstition was seemed to agitate her even further, and I worried I'd just taken a big misstep. "This is obviously very important to you," I said as I gently took her arm and hooked her hand into the crook of my elbow. "Why don't we get something to drink down in the kitchen?" The non sequitur seemed to throw her out of her head enough so that the impending panic was no longer a problem. And for a lack of anything else to say, the cockatoo woman nodded and let me lead us both to the homey kitchen next to the hearth. A pot of leftover stew was warming up on the flames, and when I lifted the lid, my stomach rumbled in appreciation at the smell of someone who knew how to cook with spices. I looked around, but the friendly sloth man and chef extraordinaire Arvid was nowhere in sight. For the time being, I would just have to make sure his excellent cooking would not go to waste. I must have gotten into my preparations a little too much, because when I turned back around, the cockatoo woman was fast asleep with her head pillowed on top of her arms. Then, as quietly as I could, I tried to set the two helpings of stew and the pitcher of clean water down quietly on the table. But even the smallest vibration had her jerking awake.
"No, I'm sorry,"
she apologized, but I waved it away as I handed her a glass of water. She took it in her trembling hand and gulped down half in one breath. "No need to apologize," I said nonchalantly, and then topped off her glass when she set it back down. "After all, you've given me the ability to avoid death in the future, right?"
I don't really know,"
she admitted after she had drained her second glass. Then she wiped the corners of her mouth dry and folded her hands primly on top of the table. She seemed a little more composed, but the crow's feet around her eyes and the lines around her mouth said otherwise. "Well, let's start with what you do know," I suggested. Vel's coal-like eyes snapped to mine with some of that old spark I recognized, and I never thought I would miss the type of attitude she was capable of throwing with just one look.
"All I know,"
she started with a terseness to her diction that made me want to chuckle,
"is there something inside of me that will not rest unless I do what it says. I don't know if other people have the same experiences or not, but it is a type of madness I would not recommend or wish on my worst enemy."
"Sounds pretty awful, actually," I said as I dunked a new spoon into the rich, gravy-like broth. "Oh, yes, come to Papa."
"Picture something inside of you that won't stop screaming and screaming and screaming until you do what it says,"
she said, just as I brought a spoonful up to my lips. If her goal was to put me off my appetite, then she would have to try harder, because it had been a while since I last had something that tasted so good in my mouth. "How do you feel now?" I asked her around the chunks of spiced meat and boiled vegetables. "Do you feel better or worse now that you were able to listen to the voice?"
"Better, I suppose."
She trailed off again and then looked around the kitchen as if she was seeing it for the first time.
"I've never felt this way before, so your guess is as good as mine. By the way, I hope you don't think I'm just a vapid person who makes a big deal about nothing. I wasn't really intending on coming here in the first place, but I couldn't not."
"I'm sure everything is in good hands," I said as I finished up the last of the leftover stew. "What do you say to something a little stronger than water? I think we both earned it."
"That sounds agreeable,"
the cockatoo woman said as she wearily pushed away her water glass. I smiled kindly at her and then turned around in search of a flagon of wine. Then I heard an alarming thud behind me, and when I whipped back around with two wine glasses in my hands, I realized I really only needed one. Apparently, the poor woman had finally allowed the exhaustion to catch up with her because she was lying face down again on the table, and I was pretty sure she was out for the count this time. "I'll take that wine," a familiar voice spoke out moments before the voice's owner peered out from the staircase above the kitchen. "Didn't your mother ever tell you eavesdropping was rude, Bowden?" I mock-teased, as I gazed upside down at the familiar raccoon face. "So you decided to join the getaway party too, huh?" "When Vel became so adamant on coming, I just had to go with her." My trusty friend and carpenter sheepishly removed his ever-present painter's cap and twisted it in his hands. "But don't you worry, sir, Mel has everything under control back at Ithaca." "I definitely trust you and your brother," I said, as I topped off his glass of wine. "I'm pretty sure between everybody we've got working for us nowadays, I'll never have to worry again. How's that going, by the way? Jenner mentioned in one of his letters that Ithaca has serfs now." "Yes, Ithaca now boasts 7 serf families that wish to unite under the crest of Brightwood." The raccoon man replaced his painter's cap and then took a sip from his glass. "They're hard workers and have already begun to transform the land around the estate." "What about Icarian?" I asked him about my second estate as I took a sip from my own glass. The taste of fiery, fruity pebbles hit the back of my tongue, and I'd never missed such an odd combination before now. "Icarian doesn't have any serf contracts, but according to Vel, several merchants in the markets are curious about joining under the Brightwood crest," Bowden informed me. "They've been seeing how well your Coley and Bumblehoney enterprises are doing, and there are talks of merchant and craft contracts in the city. Vela knows more about all that stuff, and I'm sure she can tell you once she feels better." The raccoon man trailed off as he gazed at the slumbering woman. He smiled a fond smile, but behind his masked eyes, he appeared a little forlorn. How long has she been feeling this way? I asked, as I gazed at the poor woman's white-feathered crest. She seemed peaceful now, but a moment ago she was frantic and even slightly insane, so I tried to keep my phrasing and questions simple and to the point. Based on how Bowden's shoulders curled inward slightly, I could tell no amount of phrasing would ever be gentle enough, given the situation. "It started out with the little things at first," he began as he rubbed his brow under the brim of his hat. "I thought she was just being superstitious all the time. Like not wanting me to leave without a special button or without tying my shoes a certain way. But over time, these little inconsequential things began to add up and take priority in her mind. I don't know what's causing it, but I'm deathly afraid the love of my life is going mad. That's why I couldn't let her come alone. I'm sure there's a reason for her behavior," I tried to reassure my friend, even though I was mildly concerned. "And maybe it's a reason we can figure out. Just don't lose hope. That's the last thing that'll help anybody." My words were supposed to comfort the raccoon man, but I couldn't help but see the parallels in my own situation with Amaya. Each new facet of her power was something that seemed to pull us closer to the inevitable. But thinking that I was bound to lose her? Was it really inevitable? That might be a mistake waiting to happen. Regardless, the other man seemed to understand where I was coming from, and he sighed out a little in relief. "You're right, Mr. Alex," he said, and then drained the last of his wine in one long gulp. "We are nothing without hope." "That is definitely something I will most gladly drink to," I said, and then took a page out of his book as I downed my own wine. "I'd better get her to bed properly this time," Bowden said after a few moments where we sat in shared silence. "This is the first time she's had proper rest since we've left Nada, and I should thank you for that." "All I did was accept a lucky bell," I said. "Whatever it takes," Bowden said, and then gently gathered the cockatoo woman up in his arms. "Get some rest too, okay?" I patted the other man on the shoulder as he passed me. "I'm going to need someone who can help me fly this thing." "It's good to have you back, Alex." He smiled faintly and then ascended the stairs at the back of the kitchen toward the second floor. I sighed and sat back down at the sturdy table as I soaked in this little slice of home. The galley was quaint like the rest of the three-story structure, and where Ithaca and Icarian had splashes of luxury and opulence strewn throughout the properties, the detachable top part of Monger Manor had more of a country home feel, like if the Burrow in Harry Potter could fly. But by far the best feature of this place was how much light poured in through the natural skylights. Even the window over the galley sink allowed for a surprising amount of brightness to illuminate every nook and cranny. Maybe it was because I'd spent such a long time in semi-darkness, but whatever the case, I found myself wanting to bask in the sun for a moment like a happy dandelion. I decided to take this rare moment to myself and gathered up my empty stew bowl and the glasses so I could wash them in front of the open window. Dishes were one thing I never minded doing whenever I lived with roommates or had to share the house chores. There was something meditative about the warm water and making everything clean and put to rights that I really liked. So even though I only had a handful to clean, I took my time and let the sun pouring in from the window caress my face. Then a sound caught my attention on the breeze, and I paused what I was doing for a moment. When nothing but the wind greeted me, I resumed drying the glasses with the towel in my hand, but I soon stopped when I heard it again. That was definitely not the breeze this time, but a sob. I set aside my towel and leaned over the sink to try to see through the window where the heartbreaking crying was coming from. Just when I thought all the emotional crises had passed, someone somewhere tried to muffle their growing painful sobs, and they weren't doing a very good job of it. From what I could hear, it sounded like that person was on the balcony above where the kitchen was, so I decided to investigate. It turned out the modest study was right above the kitchen, and when I entered, the sound of crying grew louder, so I followed it out to the balcony. I didn't know what I was expecting, but seeing the normally stoic Ibex woman curled over herself as she sat on the balcony's ledge was not it. It was such an unusual sight that I stood there for a moment in indecision as she continued to cry. I looked around, hoping maybe Horace was somewhere nearby, but it was just the two of us. I could walk away and try to find Horace, but something in me felt wrong about leaving her to cry by herself for even a second longer. Anwar was practically my sister-in-law, so after one more look around for any sorts of reinforcement and finding none, I carefully approached her in a way that wouldn't startle her since we were so high up. It was obvious when she became aware of my approach by the way she stiffened and tried to fiercely wipe away her tears. So I didn't call attention to the fact that she was sniffling and climbed up on the ledge next to her instead.
I apologize. I'm just about finished here, and I'll go.
The distraught Ibex woman said as she clutched her cloak tighter around herself. Don't leave on my account, I said casually, as I looked out across the canyon. The sky was such a vibrant blue, almost azure like a lapis lazuli, and the breeze smelled sweet like summertime. I took a deep breath and closed my eyes, as if I was just there minding my own business so Anwar could have a moment to compose herself. When her tears seemed to be dry, I shielded my eyes from the sun and glanced to her to make sure she was all right.
You don't have to stay, you know,
she said with a grim half-smile.
I'll be all right in a moment.
I'll leave if you want me to, I said in a tone that hopefully telegraphed a no-pressure sort of atmosphere. But if not, I'll just sit here and enjoy the sun on my face.
It is glorious, isn't it?
She tilted her own face more into the sun and took a deep breath.
Thank you for staying. Your presence isn't the least bit agitating like I thought it would be.
Right. I trailed off as I tried not to snort in my amusement. She was definitely an acquired taste to most, but I'd learned by now not to take her blunt manner to heart. You know, I'm also a pretty good listener, too. Just saying, if you think it'll help. I didn't actually expect her to take me up on the offer, because I knew how reserved she could be, especially because I wasn't the first person she'd turned to in times like this. But she proved me wrong when she shifted toward me and took a small breath.
I am unaccustomed to feeling such deep guilt for things I have no control over,
she began as she hugged herself even tighter. What do you mean? I asked.
I know why my brother and his wife are here,
she continued.
It has to do with Amaya, doesn't it?
Yeah, I said with a sigh, because there was no point in hiding the fact. But you don't have to worry, because your brother and I are going to do whatever we can to make sure she doesn't have to take that oath.
Forgive me if I still harbor some doubts,
Anwar said with an apologetic shrug.
I worry about my sister, and it has been this way since she was young, and I had to look out for her. So it is not easy to just shut the emotions off. I just can't help but think of what happens if you and my brother fail to find a solution.
What are you worried about? I prodded. The insight the Ibex woman had into her sister's actions and behavior was a perspective I was curious about.
I know Amaya,
she said.
If she has any inkling there's no hope left, she will petition for a new mage.
I arched my eyebrows and glanced at her. I didn't know an augur could do that.
It's not common, but in cases where the balance of power is uneven or abused, each augur and mage pair can petition the order for another pairing,
she explained. So Amaya will say what, you abused her or something? I questioned with a sick feeling in my gut at the thought.
Mercedes, no,
she snorted.
It may have started that way in order to protect those who are bonded by giving them a way to leave the bond if needed. Now, either one of the pairs may simply elect to do so on preference if they wish to.
Well, that's a relief, I huffed. I would hate for your reputation to be smeared like that. Anwar opened her mouth, frowned, and then closed it again like she didn't quite know what to say to that. Finally, after another false start, she was able to articulate what had her all twisted up.
You are kind enough to consider my feelings above your own desires,
she repeated in a logical voice.
It should not matter to you. And yet you have taken that detail into consideration. Amaya always says you are a virtuous man, and yet I am still surprised. If she knew, she would just shake her head at me.
I smiled as a soft look entered her opalescent eyes, and I pictured the very sight. I think I know what you mean. She's quite virtuous herself.
This is true.
Anwar's smile faltered.
And it is why I feel so guilty. If she must be forced back to the Order, she will not permit me to join her. You see, the Order does not want those among their ranks who are unwilling servants.
Aside from the prophetess, I grumbled.
Yes.
The Ibex woman nodded her long-horned head as her expression hardened.
Unfortunately, Amaya's case is a matter of her bloodline, and because of this, it is a matter of destiny. One cannot interfere with destiny.
They just haven't met me yet, I said with a cocky grin and nudged her shoulder, which teased a rare smile out of her.
I must thank you for your support of her, even though it has been tempting not to take her fully as a lover,
Anwar said, and I suddenly stiffened beside her. I cleared my throat and rubbed the back of my neck.
You two have not fully made love, correct?
She rephrased as she stared hard at me. Say that we have, I hedged. Would that really be so bad?
Are you not a traveler, then?
The Ibex woman questioned. I definitely am, I replied, and watched as her face went pale. What's the big deal?
The big deal is you should have poisoned her, and the fact she seems perfectly fine is quite curious,
she said as she stared at me with an intense expression in those multifaceted eyes.
Quite curious indeed.